Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks to all of you for coming so early in the morning. And Elizabeth, thank you for, I think, you know, probably the best setup for talking about HIA that I've had the privilege of following. That was great, and you'll see a couple of very similar graphics at the beginning of my presentation, because I'm used to having to do it myself, I think. I'll say, just sort of at a more personal level, I was a physician in clinical practice for 10 years before I came to the field of HIA, and I think those of us in primary care, I worked in underserved settings, both in an urban environment in Richmond, California, and as far out in rural areas as Bethel, Alaska, near the Bering Sea, with Alaska Native communities, and I think you struggle against the determinants of health every day in primary care. I think I probably first started paying attention when I was in residency and on an inpatient pediatrics rotation. I admitted an 8-year-old boy for asthma exacerbation 3 times in a 2-month rotation. And, you know, we had conversations on rounds about the fact he lived in public housing, that his mom reported mold on the walls, but we had no idea how, you know, do you write a prescription for a contractor to fix, you know, what do you do? And I think that this really, it's real, it's very tangible, and I think that public health has largely been turning to, you know, more and more focus on intersectoral collaboration. This I love the APHA Health in All Policies T-shirt from a couple of years ago. And so more and more you're seeing calls for this, and again, my favorite, very pretty graphic, I wonder who did this, for the National Prevention Council, but I think lots of statements in the National Prevention Strategy about the federal government will coordinate investments in transportation, housing, environmental protection, and community infrastructure to promote sustainable and healthy communities. It's wonderful. It's very exciting, and yet I think, as Elizabeth, you know, emphasized, the question is how. We don't share a common language. You can't really expect transportation engineers or labor lawyers or environmental regulators to have health expertise, nor do we understand the legal and political and technical requirements and constructs that within which these other agencies work. There aren't formalized requirements for us to work together, and there's not really a lot of forums where we're used to being in the same room. And I think we don't often have matching priorities. We have to recognize when we step up with health priorities and we would like healthy housing or a you know, healthy transportation system, that is not necessarily the mission, the mandate, the funding you know, requirements for this other agency to do its work. And so we have to find ways to sort of work within those other priorities and deadlines and timelines, et cetera. So the National Research Council sort of addressed this question by looking at the field of HIA as really, is this a framework that can facilitate really a more practical approach to incorporating health into other agencies, other sort of non-health decision-making. The committee found that HIA is a very promising tool for doing this, that it can inform a wide range of different types of decisions, and most of the talk will focus on a few examples of those. That it incorporates qualitative and quantitative data and stakeholder input, and that it really does appear to be a promising way to spark effective, sort of more tangible collaboration between agencies and agencies and other stakeholders. We defined HIA, this is very sort of drawn from the World Health Organization's definition. The pieces that I would highlight that are different are that we noted that it also considers input from stakeholders. That is a new piece of the definition. Actually, I should stop myself. How many people in the room have heard of HIA enough to have read a definition of it before? That's so many more hands than a couple of years ago. So it's working. Good. And so the other piece that I think changed in the council's definition is a little bit more emphasis on active management of effects, not just making recommendations to manage, but really looking at, you know, how could you monitor, how could you manage effects going forward. So those are a couple of changes. I'm going to get into a few examples and just hope to sort of highlight it. You know, I think one is from the local, one's from the state, and one's from the federal level of places where HIA has been used, just to give you a sense for the field and a sense for how it might fit into the Health in All Policies framework as one tool that might help us get there. This was the county's decision, a plan for sort of urban revitalization along a corridor of Highway 99 in Washington State. It involved a collaboration between the health and planning departments in that county. The findings of the HIA, very briefly, were overall the HIA recognized a lot of benefits of the plan. And I think this is something that's pretty characteristic in HIAs. When we, you know, get involved, we really try to kind of look at the pluses as well as the cons and not just focus on how are you going to hurt people and how can we prevent you from doing that. They recognize, though, that as designed, there are a lot of sort of high-flow arteries that feed the I-99, and that if you build up those areas, you might get into more and more conflicts between traffic and pedestrian traffic and create some risk as well. It would increase walking and biking near pollution hotspots, and that was a concern, as well as there were, I think, four very high-volume intersections where there was a risk of sort of worsening pedestrian and bike-related accidents. So they made a few recommendations. One of them, I think, was to create walkable hubs so that rather than having sort of development spread uniformly along the corridor, that they would really try to create hubs that didn't conflict as much with arteries, where people could walk to local services and stores and live, in a fairly compact distribution. Secondly, that for buildings located or that were going to be built near the major air pollution hotspots, that those buildings would include some central air filtration for particulates to try to mitigate the risk of putting buildings near, near bad air pollution sources. And finally, that prioritizing traffic calming measures for the four intersections that were identified with the greatest risk. A lot of those outcomes were actually incorporated into the final development plan. So it was a very positive interaction between the two agencies, and ultimately the planning department included a lot of these recommendations in the final plan. The second was an HIA done of a state legislative policy. So energy prices spiked after Hurricane Katrina, and as some of you may remember, there was a very severe winter, the winter after Katrina in the Northeast, very cold temperatures, and this really put a major burden on low-income families. So the Low-Income Housing Energy Assistance Program provides energy assistance. It was somewhat underfunded, and that was compounded by the increase in energy prices and energy use that winter. So a group of, I think, mainly pediatricians actually did what they called a child health impact assessment because they focused on the impacts on children. Otherwise, I think it was very much a standard HIA. They recognized that, they did a series of stakeholder interviews, literature reviews. They looked at some ER records, I believe, and recognized that people were crowding into one room and using a space heater, turning off the heat in the building, that there was a risk of pneumonia and other respiratory infections, a risk of burns from unsafe heating sources, a risk of carbon monoxide poisoning. People were sometimes crowding into the kitchen and using the oven to heat the house, and a risk also of sort of heat or eat choices that people are having to decide, are we going to pay to heat our house, or are we going to be cold and buy food? And also, I think importantly, without doing any quantification, this is a pretty rapid HIA. The team did point out that this would have implications for Medicaid expenditures because the majority of the recipients of this program are also on Medicaid, and if they're coming into the ER with burns and carbon monoxide poisoning and respiratory infections, this is ultimately going to end up on the state's bill. So they recommended pretty simply increasing funding. They made another series of recommendations to kind of fine-tune the efficiency of the program and also recommended some evaluation parameters to see how are people using it and is it being used the most efficiently. The state controller recognized that this had major implications for state expenditures, and the legislature ultimately increased funding substantially. The third is work that I did in Alaska. How many of you have participated in an environmental impact statement? And that's maybe more than average. I'd say the vast majority of people, including the state health department in Alaska, where there are probably more EISs done every year than almost any other state, had never even heard of one, basically. I talked to them about EIS. They thought I was talking about the fellowship from CDC. And this was a proposal in the North Slope of Alaska, where the Trans-Alaska Pipeline starts at Prudhoe Bay, to, let's see, does the mouse, no, it does. So that's where the Trans-Alaska Pipeline begins. Orange is oil and gas leases. And these points on the map are Alaska Native villages. The proposal was to lease lands in this area, very, very essential area for the the surrounding villages' food supply, as well as sort of their history and culture. This is where people hunt and fish. And oil and gas leasing had been allowed in most of this area, and the communities support it because it's a big part of their income, but as well, they depend on this for food. They call it their grocery store. taking a very, very unusual step, the local government had been very deeply at odds with the Bureau of Land Management. In fact, considering signing on with some environmental groups as a friend of the court in litigation that necessitated this EIS. This was the second EIS for the same proposal. The Bush administration had proposed to lease lands. They did an EIS, 3,000 pages, 2 years of work, got taken to court. The court vacated the EIS, and the agency had to go back to the drawing board. So talk about efficiency. This time, instead, though, the North Slope Borough, the local government, and the local health department became what's called a cooperating agency, allowed under the National Environmental Policy Act as a way that local and state health departments or other agencies can participate in EIS. The local health department drafted an HIA, and the BLM incorporated that HIA essentially unedited into the EIS. Now, this didn't happen easily. This was the result of about a year of negotiation between the solicitors for the agency and lawyers for the North Slope Borough. The new area director for the BLM came on, and he said, huh, so this is the way to avoid the next lawsuit. And essentially, the North Slope Borough said, yeah. And so this was motivation, I think, to Elizabeth's point about, what are the different motivators. I think that the agency really recommended this was actually a way to potentially avoid the conflict that can happen between agencies and communities taking controversial actions and actually perhaps through coordination lead to a more efficient process. Community testimony, people recognize both benefits. This funds, for example, the most costly per capita water and sanitation system in the country, if not the world. The oil revenue funds a lot of the borough's services, the health department. People also voice a lot of concerns. So social cohesion, major change if you've got 1,000 oil workers coming into a small native community of 500 people. People had the classic environmental concerns about exposure to pollutants. People also worried a lot about the food supply, both would animals be driven far away from the village where they couldn't hunt, or, would they be... Would they be contaminated? So the BLM incorporated a number of mitigation measures. We proposed about 15. They did what they felt like they could within their statutes and sort of ability. First of all, there will be further tiers of the EIS process when there are projects proposed out on leased land. So BLM agreed that they will consult with the health departments for future EISs. And in fact, they have done so. They're now collaborating with the community again on a second EIS for more specific decisions around development there. They agreed to expand a required cultural orientation for any workers that were going to come to the area. They agreed to additional baseline air quality modeling and monitoring that goes a little bit above the Clean Air Act requirements. And they agreed to requiring baseline levels and monitoring for any contaminant that would be discharged in substantial quantities, not in the air or the water, but actually in the food supply, which really would help this community because a lot of times people will stop eating their food if they're worried about contamination. So this was a way of really reassuring people. Longer term, this is where it really gets to health and all policies. This has had major ripple effects in this state. First of all, the state of Alaska has a large project permitting team. They participate in every project-level environmental impact statement as a cooperating agency. The large project permitting team consisted of the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Fish and Game, no health department. and that's sort of remarkable when you really think about the scope of activity that is covered under some level of environmental impact assessment. There was a joint federal tribal state working group on HIA formed in Alaska. They developed a guidance. The state health department is now a formal part of the large project permitting team. They have a fully funded HIA program at the state health department, and the state health department is now engaged in 9 separate EISs doing HIAs. So it's really led to a major change in the way that state government works on resource development. And you're starting to see other areas of the U.S. pick this up and try to do it. Internationally, HIA has been done for a long time. It's, you know, maybe 10 years in the U.S., whereas, internationally for at least 20 years. It's interesting that you've started to see large corporations and major development lenders picking this up. The International Council on Mining and Metals, for example, has guidance on health impact assessment. I think recognizing that good planning is ultimately going to lower operating costs and lower business costs and lead to a healthier workforce and in fact, manage legal risk as well. If you address and disclose risks, ahead of time, you're less likely to get bit by them in the long run. So, let's see. This is a map that we have on our website, healthimpactproject.org. You can look at all of the HIAs and find information about each one of them, look up the full reports if they're available, et cetera. I think we did a little bit of a survey talking to HIA practitioners. I think we heard, you know, similar to the Alaska case, that very frequently an HIA is a great way to start a conversation. You start with one specific decision, you work on an interagency, developing an interagency collaboration, and then you actually find that it leads to all sorts of other actions that don't involve necessarily doing an HIA for every decision, but more broadly, just incorporating health into decision making. So there are a few opportunities, I think, at the federal level. HIA is a great tool for agency decision-making. Not all decisions. We don't recommend doing an HIA for every agency decision by any means, but I think for high-value ones, it might be a good way to spark collaboration. I think agencies can also include HIA as a fundable activity in federal grant programs, housing, transportation, what have you. I think incorporating health criteria into funding requirements would also spark then, you know, local or metropolitan planning organizations or state transportation departments, housing authorities to begin doing HIA or finding other ways to really think through systematically what are the health implications of what we're doing. It's very, you know, the National Prevention Council has been looking a lot at HIA, and there is some coordination with existing efforts, and for example, the National Network of Public Health Institutes and National Association of City and County Health Officials. So, thank you very much.